and you're listening to KPFK Los Angeles, 90.7 FM, non-commercial, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio for all of Southern and parts of Central California, also broadcasting in Santa Barbara County at 98.7 FM. Coming up tonight on Something's Happening, we're going to have Health Night embedded within a Pacifica sandwich. What happened? My intro card didn't work. Gotta do that again. There we go. All right.
Welcome to the Something's Happening Show. 6 hours of dynamite radio. From now until 6 o'clock, we will bring you drama and literature, poetry and commentary, readings and interviews, old radio, science fiction, and new consciousness programs. And here is your host,
faster than a speeding bullet, more powerful than a locomotive, able to leap tall buildings at a single bound. Look, up in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane, it's
Roy of Hollywood.
Good morning, good evening, and good day. This is your host, producer, and engineer, Roy of Hollywood, welcoming you again to Something's Happening. And we'll be here till 6 a.m. with the Dynamite Radio for Night People. And as promised, we have our health and environment night, but we are going to embed it in a Pacifica sandwich. The farther part of the sandwich happens at 5 a.m., and we'll be interviewing Barbara Cady, who hasn't been a programmer here for 20 years, but was a major influence here at KPFK and also on me, somebody I really admired for great work on the air during the Watergate times, our golden age. And our first half of the sandwich is an interview live with Matthew Lazar, L-A-S-A-R, Matthew Lazar. He has a new book. It's so new that it isn't even published yet, but they're printing it and boxing it and beginning to mail it out. And it's called Pacifica Radio, The Rise of an Alternative Network. Matthew Lazar, L-A-S-A-R. And I'm very excited about this book, and I also think that I might be surprised if very many people other than a small group would be excited about it, although it's a subject and an institution I've devoted a great deal of my life to, and I think, although maybe outside of history, has had a very important effect as a catalyst on historical events for the last 50 years, but that's my particular prejudice. Matthew Lazar is, well, we're going to find out who Matthew Lazar is, and we're going to find out about who are the gang that put this thing together back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and the roots, which are always very interested in. Roots is the roots of Pacifica from this book, Pacifica Radio, The Rise of an Alternative Network. Matthew?
Hi, good evening.
Oh, good evening.
Very nice to be part of your sandwich.
Okay, well, I'm really excited about this book. I can't wait to get my hands on one.
Me too.
Who is Matthew Lazar that you write a book about Pacifica Radio?
Well, I'm a longtime Pacifica listener. I started listening to WVAI in New York City in the 1960s, and I occasionally volunteered at WVAI in the 1970s. They used to have something called the Free Music Store, and I used to go over there and help set it up, and sometimes I would sit at the phones and take phone calls during marathon pledges. In the 1980s, I moved to California, and I was a dedicated volunteer at KPFA in the news department. I was pretty much doing nothing but volunteering at KPFA from about 1983 to about 1990. And after that, I decided to go to graduate school. I eventually went to the Claremont Graduate School, which is within radio shot of your wonderful radio station. And I got a PhD in history. And I decided to write my thesis on, well, guess what?
The early years of the
Pacifica Foundation. I figured, why not? This is an ideal opportunity to find out about this network that's been so important in my life. And so I did. I produced a dissertation on the subject, and somebody came along and said, this looks good enough, and we'll publish it. And that's Temple University Press, and it'll be out and available this month.
Oh,
well, that's the short version, I guess.
Well, we don't need the short version, actually. We have more time than that. We like to take things slow and chew on them here at night. How did you do your research?
Well, the book, the research for the book is a combination of a lot of things. It's I did a lot of oral histories of people from the early years. And I'm happy to say that I did them about when I did them, because many of the people who I did oral histories of have now passed away in the last year. I did two oral histories with Henry Roy Finch, who was probably Lewis Hill's closest confidant and who lived in New Rochelle on the East Coast. Did oral history interviews with Eleanor McKinney, who I'm happy to say is still alive.
She was the first program director.
And with a lot of other people, Trevor Thomas, who was acting president of the Pacifica Foundation and manager of KPFA during its most difficult period, the early 1960s, and who I'm sorry to say died just a couple of weeks ago, and many other people. I basically traveled around as far as I could with my tape recorder, and I did a lot of oral histories. I also managed to find a great deal of actual archival material in the KPFA building, which had been just sort of sitting around, and I took it upon myself to carefully archive it and box it and catalog it. At one point, the most wonderful thing that happened was that Eleanor McKinney, I kept on bothering, I guess, Eleanor McKinney about the fact that people were saying that she had an old box of letters in her basement. She kept on saying to me, "Nah, I don't have it." And I said, "Wouldn't you just like to look in your basement and see?" And one day she called me back and she said, "Matthew, you were right. I have about 300 letters from Lewis Hill in my basement." And she took those letters and she mailed them to me, and I read them. That was a wonderful, wonderful experience. I also benefited from many oral histories that were done by Veronica Selver, who was making a film about KPFA, which I think should be available pretty soon, sometime this year. There are many books, recollections. Of course, I spent a lot of time in your wonderful Pacifica archives, where I listened to many old shows. And
yeah, it's over 40,000 tapes in there.
Marvelous, marvelous, marvelous archive. Invaluable. One of the best things in the United States in terms of research about post-World War II America, the Pacifica National Archives. More people should know about it. So I spent a lot of time listening to tapes there. Let's see if I left anything out. I think that's basically all the things that I used. I used government documents. I found a old box that people had pretty much forgotten about in the KPFA office building of KPFA's and the Pacifica Foundation's old FBI files, which the Pacifica Foundation had gotten in the 1970s with the Freedom of Information Act, and I read those. I benefited from previous histories and memoirs which had been written by many people, from Paul Dallas, who was manager of your radio station at one point, wrote a very funny book called Dallas in Wonderland, to Steve Post. Lewis Hill wrote many articles and things, and lots of other people wrote personal memoirs, things like that, and I put those all together into a book which basically covers from the 1930s to the early 1960s. It has a few impressionistic things to say about the rest of the period, but really it's just about the early years.
And, of course, we opened here in 1959, so you are mostly about the people who started the whole institution of Pacifica and the rise and fall and rise of KPFA in Berkeley.
That's
and
right.
The infancy of KPFK here.
I talk a little bit about the infancy. I interviewed a few people who were part of that period. Gene Marine is somebody who I interviewed and who had been at KPFK in its earliest incarnation. And I also looked at some early documents of the pacifists who helped build KPFK, especially William Webb, who was a CEO during the Second World War. And we'll get into that in a little while. You know, one of the things that I think it's very important to remember and celebrate about the early years is that when you look at the early years of the Pacifica Foundation, you realize that it's an institution which is very old. People don't really think about this, but some of the people who walked around in 2207 Shattuck Avenue in Berkeley in the 1950s had been born and raised in the late 19th century. People like Alexander Micklejohn were people who had really grown up in the late 19th century.
On liberty.
That's right. And so the institution has a heritage which is very old and goes back way before the year that KPFA went on the air, which is 1949.
Now, how do you trace the foundation of the station that went on the air in 1949 back to, well, you were talking about particularly the 30s? What's going on that is pre-station?
Yeah, right. Well, let's take it from even further back than the 1930s. Let's take it to the First World War. The First World War was, of course, supposed to be the war that ended all wars. By the 1930s, there was enormous disillusionment in the United States over the First World War. Most people regarded U.S. entry into the First World War as having been an enormous mistake. And because of that, pacifism was a very appealing philosophy in the 1930s. Everybody was a pacifist in the 1930s. Well, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but a lot of people were pacifists in the 1930s. Most people said nice things about pacifism. To give you an idea of how popular the ideology was in the 1930s, in 1939, Time magazine ran an article about A.J. Mustey, who was an important peace activist in the post-World War II era as he was in the 1930s, in which they identified him as America's number one pacifist. Now, can you imagine in 1999, Time magazine taking the trouble to identify America's number one pacifist?
Not precisely, no. Is it A.J. Mustey, M-U-S-T-Y?
M-U-S-T-E.
M-U-S-T-E.
A very important voice in the 1950s and 1960s, but more in the 1930s, I think, and a very important force in pacifism. In any event, everybody was a pacifist. Franklin Roosevelt got up in front of an audience at one point and he said, "I am a pacifist, and I assume you're all pacifists, too." Republicans, Trotskyists, socialists. There were, within the core of this, there was a sort of a left-wing pacifism and a right-wing pacifism. The Communist Party of the United States at one point embraced pacifism during the 1930s because they saw it as an anti-imperialist philosophy, a philosophy which would keep the United States and Europe out of the developing third world, the emerging post-colonial world. For the right, pacifism was appealing because they were isolationists, and they didn't want the United States to get involved in any wars overseas. Within that coalition, there were these people who belonged to the War Resisters League and the American Friends Service Committee and the Fellowship of Reconciliation, who belonged to many of the pacifist student clubs, and who had various theories and ideas about pacifism. Some of them were secular, some of them were spiritual, many of them based on disillusionment over the First World War. And most of the people who started the Pacifica Foundation had some connection with those pacifist student clubs, especially the War Resisters League. These are forgotten names that I'm sure perhaps you know. You know, you've ever heard of Americo Chiarito?
I know Gert Chiarito.
Well, Americo Chiarito was Gertrude Chiarito's husband. And Americo Chiarito was a member of the War Resisters League. He was, he and Gertrude married during the Second World War. She was the Postmaster General in Elkton, Oregon, and he met her because she would deliver the mail to the CO camp during the Second World War.
That's a CO camp. That's where they put
conscientious objector camp, and we'll get to that in a minute.
Okay.
A lot of these pacifists belonged to these organizations during the 1930s. Lewis Hill was one of the people who very strongly believed in pacifism. We'll get to Lewis Hill in a little while. All of these people thought that they were the talk of the town in the 1930s. They thought that they were going that pacifism was going to triumph. And then as soon as Nazi Germany attacked the Soviet Union in the summer of 1941, and then Japan attacked Pearl Harbor in December of 1941, this enormous pacifist coalition, which had existed, completely disappeared, leaving this small group of dedicated pacifists who were pacifists for various sort of spiritual secular reasons, all dressed up with no place to go. So this small group of people wound up in these conscientious objectors camps all across the United States, where they were extremely isolated, extremely bitter about what had happened. They were shocked, as a matter of fact, at the fact that this enormous pacifist coalition disappeared so quickly.
Now, these camps, these were places where the government rounded up pacifists?
Well, they didn't exactly round them up. What had happened was that during the First World War, pacifists had had a really horrible time. Most of them had wound up going into prison.
Like Bertrand Russell.
Yeah, where they had really awful experiences, were beaten, abused, beaten by the other prisoners. Pacifists had a really bad time during the First World War. In the Second World War, three major peace churches, the Quakers, the Mennonites, and the Brethren, cut a deal with the Selective Service. And they said, look, let's not do this again, okay? We will take care of these pacifists in these work camps, which were sort of modeled after the Civilian Conservation Corps, the New Deal. We'll take care of these people. You can oversee the matter, but we'll just hold them in these places, and they'll do what was considered nationally significant work. So that basically there was this relatively safe place for pacifists, conscientious objectors to go during the Second World War. And these were all over the United States. Many of them were around the Bay Area and in Northern California and in Washington and in Oregon. One of them was in Colesville, California, which is about 30 miles south of Reno. It's on the, you know, California has a sort of easternmost corner, and it's right there in that little corner. You can drive along the 80 and then take the 4, I think, and you can get there relatively easily now. And this is the CO camp where Henry Roy Finch and Lewis Hill found themselves in 1942, and where they wound up talking about the ideas which eventually became the fundamental ideas for the Pacifica Foundation. Now, perhaps at this point it would be a good idea to back up and ask the question, who exactly was Lewis Hill and where did he come from? And maybe take some time with that.
Yes, please.
All right. In order to begin this, we got to go back to Lewis Hill's father, a man named Johnson Hill. And what I'm about to tell you, some of this is in my book, some of this is impressionistic material that I gleaned from various people, including Lewis Hill's brother Robert, and various other individuals. That is, it's sort of my take on Lewis Hill and what he was about and how he came to be who he was. Johnson Hill came from an old Virginia family. I think that his father was a doctor. That's what Joy Hill once told me, who was Lewis Hill's widow. He came from an old fine Virginia family, and he decided to go west and make his fortune. And he went to Missouri, and he got himself a job as a county lawyer. I think he was the county attorney for El Dorado County. At some point, he decided that he was going to go even further west and try his hand and his fortune in Oklahoma. And in Oklahoma, this is in the early 20th century, Johnson Hill met a woman named Laura Phillips. Laura Phillips was doubtless a very intelligent, very attractive young woman. I also think it probably did not hurt that she was the youngest sister of Frank Phillips, who was the head of the Phillips Petroleum Company. You've ever heard of Phillips 66?
Yes.
Okay, well, Laura Phillips was the youngest sister of Frank Phillips. Johnson Hill and Laura Phillips got married, and they settled in Oklahoma in the Tulsa area. And they had three sons. The first son was, not surprisingly, Johnson Jr. Then they had a son named Robert. And then they had a son named Lewis. Johnson Hill basically became a kind of an empire builder in Oklahoma. He went into the oil business. He went into the insurance business. He went into politics. He became the Speaker of the Assembly of Oklahoma during the Second World War. He almost ran for governor, but then he decided not to for various reasons. And Lewis Hill grew up in what he once described as an atmosphere of romantic ladies, corporate wealth, and unlimited scotch and soda. That's how he described it to a friend of his at one point. He sometimes would go over to his Uncle Frank's house and gigantic mansion in Bartlesville, where, you know, it was one of these places where you had to drive, you know, you got to the front gate and then you had to drive, and it was this huge medieval mansion which Frank Phillips had, where he would entertain the likes of Tom Mix and Herbert Hoover and Amy Semple McPherson. All of these celebrities would come to the house, and Lewis Hill grew up in this atmosphere of enormous opulence and power. Oklahoma had just become a state very shortly before Lewis Hill was born in 1919. It was a state which was dominated early on by the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s. It was ripe corruption, a very, very volatile atmosphere. And in that atmosphere, Lewis Hill grew up. His father was someone of two minds, as far as I can tell. Johnson Hill was, on one level, a very ambitious go-getter, ruthless, and very anxious to create his own empire. He was also interested in the fine arts and in philosophy. And Johnson Hill actually wrote three philosophy books, which I found, to my amazement, in the UC Berkeley library. One on philosophy of agriculture, one on philosophy of politics, and one that dealt a lot with Socrates. Lewis Hill grew up in this sort of atmosphere in which Johnson Hill had these two conflicting ambitions for Lewis. One was that he would be a philosopher and an intellectual, and the other was that he would be this ruthless businessman, that he would go into the oil business and somehow get up on the rig and be a real he-man, something along those lines. Lewis Hill was a very precocious child. At the age of 6, he built himself a little radio. By the age of 12 or 13, he built a toy horse. He was incredibly good with mechanical devices. He built himself a toy horse, which Johnson Hill had patented. But despite the fact that Lewis was interested in playing the piano and all of these things that Johnson had encouraged him to do, when Lewis was a young man of about 14, 13, Johnson decided to do what he decided to do with all of his sons, which is to send them away to separate military academies. All three of the Hill boys were sent away to separate military academies. Lewis Hill was sent away to the Wentworth Military Academy in Missouri, which he absolutely hated. He detested it. And where he cultivated a lifelong contempt for militarism. He basically hid out in the orchestra where he played the piano with the band. And as soon as he could possibly get away with it, he transferred to Stanford University, where he apparently had a hobby of flying airplanes, and he studied philosophy, and he studied poetry. He immediately took on with the great poetry pedagogue Ivor Winters, who was a very influential person in the literary culture of the San Francisco Bay Area. So it was not surprising, given this kind of contradictory upbringing that Lewis Hill had, that he came to fall in with the pacifist movement of the 1930s. Now, one of the things that I found very frustrating about my research was that I was unable to find a single letter in anything that Lewis Hill has written. And he's written lots of letters, lots of stuff, in which he explained exactly why it was he decided to become a conscientious objector during the Second World War. But he clearly decided to go in that direction. Also, during his years at Stanford, he became very, very interested in the writings of Soren Kierkegaard. A lot of people say that a lot of people tend to trace Lewis Hill's ideas to Gandhian pacifism, to the ideas of Gandhi, or to Quakerism. But I found that in his early letters, what he was really interested in was in Kierkegaard and in Kierkegaard's ideas. But before I go on with this, I just really told you a mouthful. Is there anything you want to ask me?
No, I'm just enjoying this narrative. This is all new. It's going back before 1946. And so please take off and...
Okay, sure, no problem. I have to tell you that as somebody who is also a pretty faithful KPFA volunteer, that it was very new to me, too. I mean, it really was quite stunning. I just had no idea about most of this stuff. Lewis Hill loved Kierkegaard. He read Fear and Trembling, and he read all of these different books that Kierkegaard wrote. And to give you a quick and dirty, summary of the ideas of Kierkegaard, Kierkegaard's really radical idea, he was a Christian philosopher, essentially, and his really radical contribution to Christian philosophy is contained in a single sort of very interesting question, which is, if God were to appear to you, how would you know it was God? I mean, would you really know? I mean, could you really be sure that it was God? Absolutely. It could be some incredible fake, something like that.
The Wizard of Oz.
The Wizard of Oz, anything, who knows? How would you know it was God? Kierkegaard said that, ultimately, God is in your belief in God. It is within your belief, it is within your faith that God exists. And from this came, and this, some philosophers, I'm sure that there are, I'm not a philosophy major, but this is my take on Kierkegaard, and I think it was Lewis Hill's take on Kierkegaard. From this came the idea which we call existentialism, the idea that we create reality by our perceptions and our beliefs. And Lewis Hill really glommed onto this idea that people create reality by one's perceptions and by one's beliefs. That was his fundamental I don't know
his
how to
philosophical position.
His philosophical position.
He sounds like a New Age kind of guy.
Well, I think that he wouldn't have seen himself as a New Age kind of guy, at least in terms of his style. I think that if people today were to meet Lewis Hill, they would experience him as personally a very conservative person.
A lot of people didn't like him.
Well, people found him irritating and difficult in many instances, and a lot of people were, of course, competitive with him, which is not a surprising thing if you know anything about working in a community radio station or Pacifica history. But in any event, ultimately, Hill believed that peace and the creation of a better world was dependent upon the individual willingness of human beings to make that world a better world. That is being the fundamental idea, I think, of his kind of positivist existentialism. In any event, in 1942, after he had studied all these things and studied all of these ideas, he wound up going to a CO camp. He registered as a conscientious objector. He actually probably could have not been a conscientious objector because he had an extremely bad physical condition, which is that he had arthritis of the spine, which kept him in agony for most of his life. But he decided that he wanted to declare himself a conscientious objector, and he did so, and he wound up in Colville. Roy Finch told me this marvelous story first meeting Lewis Hill in Colville. Roy Finch was, he was raking some leaves or something like that, some point in 1942, and this man dressed in this incredibly fancy camping outfit shows up at the front door of the CO camp, dressed in this sort of Abercrombie and Finch kind of clothing, and speaks and comes up and asks if he's in the right place in what Roy Finch described as this wonderfully aristocratic, mellifluous voice. And immediately, Finch was just amazed at this person. Of course, Finch himself had gone to Yale and probably grew up in a relatively affluent family, so the two of them probably got along fairly well as a result of that. But they both spent a lot of time talking about pacifism and about philosophy. Ultimately, Roy Finch got a PhD in philosophy himself and wrote a lot about the teachings of Wittgenstein, who Lewis Hill was also very interested in. In any event, the two of them talked it up, and they began to ask the question which many of these pacifists started asking, which is, where did we go wrong? We thought that everybody was going to be a pacifist, and instead they all marched off to this war. Where did we go wrong? And what they decided was, what Lewis Hill certainly decided was that while the pacifists of the 1930s had done a very good job of protesting war, they had never really done a very good job of convincing people that peace was possible, of creating an environment in which people in their hearts would get the sense that peace was really possible. And so what they decided was that they wanted a radio station where individuals would talk to each other and relate to each other. People with very different ideas would be in what Roy Finch called a living room, where they would meet each other often for the first time and would try to work out their problems with each other in a cooperative dialogue oriented situation. This would both, and the other thing that would happen was that the people who would moderate this discussion would be pacifists who would try to center the dialogue around pacifist anarchist questions. Is world government possible in our lifetime? Is atomic energy a threat to our civil liberties? So that you would have a radio station in which pacifism would be both advocated and demonstrated at the same time. People would hear pacifist ideas, but they would also hear a sense of the possibility of a world in which people could nonviolently resolve conflict. What Lewis Hill called the Pacific world in our time. This was not a progressivist vision. This was an existentialist vision. We're going to create the Pacific world in our time now. That's what KPFA was designed to be. Lewis Hill, his back got worse and worse. Eventually, he couldn't stand it any longer, and he got a discharge, and he went back to Tulsa, and he began writing letters to the American Civil Liberties Union. This is about 1943. We're about 1943 at this point. He began writing letters to the American Civil Liberties Union, asking if he could get a job there, helping all the CEOs across the United States with their problems, and I'll get to that in a second. The American Civil Liberties Union had a small committee which was designed to help conscientious objectors. There were many conscientious objectors who deeply resented the fact that they had been holed up in these small little camps all over the United States and felt that they were basically being shunted off to places where they were harmless and where they could not preach against war. And so many of them would go on strike in these camps, and they would wind up in prison. They would do work strikes, or they would do hunger strikes. They would get sent to prison, and they would engage in prison strikes in the prison. They would go on hunger strikes in the prison. Sometimes they would go to prisons where there were Jim Crow conditions, and they would go on strike against the Jim Crow conditions.
Just troublemakers wherever they went.
Well, they were definitely troublemakers. They saw it as their job to be. They saw it as their job to be troublemakers for peace.
Right.
There's no question about it. And they, you know, when people said, "But you're just a tiny little group of people," they would take out their copy of Thoreau's On Civil Disobedience, and they would say, "It only takes a few people, to get things going, and we're the people." So Hill got a job at the American Civil Liberties Union, what was called the National Committee for Conscientious Objectors of the American Civil Liberties Union, in which he advocated for conscientious objectors. He advocated for them to be paid for their work in CO camps. Many of them did not receive any pay. They got like about 9 cents a day or something like that in food for their work. He advocated for them when they wound up in jail. Many of them wound up in McNeil Island, in the McNeil Island prison, which is in Washington. William Webb, who was one of the fundraisers for KPFK in Los Angeles, had spent a bunch of time in McNeil Island, which was considered a particularly brutal prison, where a lot of conscientious objectors left it kind of emotionally damaged because it had been a notoriously vicious prison where the guards would essentially try to beat the COs into joining the draft. You know, we'll let you if you'll join the draft, we'll let you out of here. And of course, they would just beat them and abuse them in all kinds of ways. Hill would advocate for these people. He would try to help the ones who went on strike. In Glendora, California, there was a particularly nasty CO strike in 1946. A lot of the COs had not been demobilized yet, and they were still in Glendora in 1946, and Hill tried to help with this. But as time went on, Hill became increasingly disillusioned with this kind of rebellion among the conscientious objectors, and he wrote about this a lot in his letters, and I talk about this in my book. He became very disillusioned with the kind of this kind of rebellion. What he saw was all these pacifists engaged in this kind of remote, inexplicable convulsions in these CO camps, while the rest of the country was completely absorbed in this vast global conflict. Here were these COs, and these COs were just totally absorbed in their own little rebellions. And what Hill realized was that pacifists had to get out from beyond the pacifist in-crowd. They had to stop just preaching to the pacifist converted, and they had to create institutions that moved beyond these small little cliques. And so he eventually quit this ACLU group that he was running. During this time, also, he got a job in a radio station. In Washington, D.C. It was called WINX. At that time, it was owned by the Washington Post, I believe. And he had a wonderful voice. Have you ever heard Lewis Hill?
Oh, yes. We have some Lewis Hill reading his poetry, and then he makes appearances in Pacifica is 25 major.
Yeah, Larry Joseph's documentary.
Yes, so one of the great programs.
And also, he's I'm sure you have that tape of him moderating a panel discussion about the Howell controversy in 1956 or 1957.
Right, I haven't heard that one.
With Lawrence Ferlinghetti and Mark Shorer, talking about, and it also includes Allen Ginsberg, of course, reading Howell on KPFA.
Slightly edited.
Slightly edited. And I talk about the edits in my book.
By the way, I've played the unedited version several times on this show.
That's good. Where was I?
We're talking about the voice of Lewis Hill. He was working at
WINX, and I wanted to ask you a question. This is a Pacifica person to Pacifica person question. Have you ever heard the dog food story of Lewis Hill?
The dog food story? No.
All right. I heard, when I was at WBI and also, at KPFA, I heard the dog food story, and this is the way the dog food story went. One day, Lewis Hill was reading some battle casualties, about battle casualties for WINX, and somebody handed him a dog food commercial to read right after the battle casualties. And he refused to read it, and he just got off the air, and then he realized suddenly that now we needed a radio station that was non-commercial. And that's how he got the idea for KPFA. Well, of course, like all wonderful myths, this is a wonderful myth, and the reality was that it's something like that. In around 1943, maybe 1944, now I don't remember, but he was handed a story about a Japanese relocation camp in Northern California, Tule Lake. And he looked at the story. He had actually been to a relocation camp. Most of the conscientious objectors during the Second World War were horrified by the Japanese-American relocation camps and had tried to stop them from happening. And Lewis Hill was one of those people. And he looked at this story, and something about the story was false. And he went to the editor, and he said, "This story is false. I won't read it." And they told him if he didn't read it, he'd be fired. And he just walked off. He just walked off the job. Lewis Hill wrote later on that while he enjoyed being a radio announcer, he was horrified by the falsehood of his job. He was horrified by the fact that frequently he would read things that he had not written, that he had no chance to verify. And he often talked to audiences about the fact that when he was at WINX, they had some kind of a job application test that they would do with people, which is that they would give them a page full of nonsense words, words just sort of randomly put together, and they would ask the applicant to read the words to see whether a person could read all these nonsense sentences and sound nice. And Hill wrote an essay later on in which he talked about the fact that, to him, this was no different than being a soldier. In both instances, you're given something, and you're told to just go out and do something with it without really thinking about the consequences of what you're doing. It was at this point, after WINX and after his experiences in the CEO camps, that Hill decided that he was going to go back to the San Francisco Bay Area and try to start a listener-sponsored radio station. But not before one very, very interesting project, which I would like to tell you about. In 1945, Hill decided that he wanted to sort of break out of the kind of pattern that he saw pacifists engaging in. And he decided to embark, along with Roy Finch, in what he called the Japanese Project, which is that somehow he managed to contact a bunch of Japanese clergy people, and he and they were going to both build boats. He and a bunch of pacifists in California, and they from Japan, were both going to build boats, and they were going to meet each other in the middle of the Pacific, and they were going to call on both countries to end the war in the Pacific. This was called the Japanese Project. And they went very far with this. They got a lot of money from a lot of pacifists, and they were going to try and do it. And the point was for Hill was to try to break out of this kind of insular pacifism in which people were fighting the CO, in which pacifists were fighting the CO camps, and try as much as possible to raise pacifism as an issue on an international level. Unfortunately, for this project, as well as for the people of Hiroshima, on August 6, 1945, the United States bombed Hiroshima with the first atomic weapon, and then 3 days later Nagasaki, and that basically ended Lewis Hill's Japanese project. And it was at this point that in 1946, he relocated with Joy Cole, who he had met at WINX and who he married there, and they both moved to San Francisco, and they started working to build KPFA.